We will certainly in November experience change in our governmental structure. There will be congressmen and senators who have been in office who will be removed from office by the will of the voters, some who will retire from their offices to be replaced by those who are eager to fill those seats. In another 2 years, we'll see an exchange of the presidency to a new president, whomever that person may be, and there's much speculation about that already. But one of the things that's interesting about the government and the country in which we live is that will not be accompanied by great turmoil. It is unusual in the history of the world for a change of government to not result in great turmoil and unrest. Particularly was that true in countries that had kings, where nations believed that kings had blue blood in them and that they reigned not necessarily by their intelligence or their power, but by the right of their genetic makeup. It was important when a king was removed from his throne to wipe out all vestiges of his heritage, that nobody remain from that king's family to rise up in the future and say, I'm the rightful king, I have flowing within me the blood of the former king, and rally the people to them. So common, in fact, that it earned its own name, regicide. The destruction, the death of the family of the regent or regal one. No pun intended, Mark. So. And that is exactly what we read about at the beginning of 2 Samuel. King Saul has died at the hands of the Philistines in battle. He's actually died by his own hand, and then his body has been assumed by the Philistines, who mutilate it terribly. Jonathan has died in battle, the heir to the throne by birthright, though he has already given that over to David by covenant. And then what happens following that is a great deal of unrest. In chapters 2 and 3, there's some maneuvering back and forth with Abner involved, the general of Saul's army, who goes to David's side to negotiate a transfer of power to David. I can deliver Saul's family willingly into your hands. Everything can make a transition and you'll be the rightful king. Take me on. And then the sons of Zeruiah, Joab and his brothers, find out about that and they slay Abner, putting David in a precarious position because David looks like he orchestrated the death of Abner, a relatively innocent man. So David has to go to the funeral of Abner and weep and mourn, and rightly so. He does, by his heart's feelings, mourn the loss of Abner. It's not a show. But in chapter 4, where I want to begin our story this evening, 2 Samuel chapter 4, I invite you to take your Bibles now. I want to look at one verse there, and then we're going right to chapter 9. Something interesting happens. When Abner dies and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, decides the throne can no longer be his, Ishbosheth flees. And all the household of Saul goes into panic mode. And they all fly away from the palace thinking that David is coming to destroy all of them. And it is in that context that verse 4 is found in 2 Samuel chapter 4. Now Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the report of Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. See, I set up that context for you. They flee because they think now the slaughter of all the house of Saul will begin. And it says, and it happened that in her hurry to flee, he fell and he became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, a study in gracefulness, is the title of our lesson this evening. And that is a bit of a play on words, because Mephibosheth would have been anything but graceful in his mobility. He is unable to walk. He is lame in both his feet by this tragic miscalculation on the part of a nurse who drops him in such a way that he does not walk again. Now we move forward in the reign of David as king to chapter 9. And that's where the bulk of our story takes place this evening. Chapter 9. And David said, "Is there yet anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. And they called him to David, and the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." The king said, "Is there not yet any one of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "Well, there is still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet." So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, in Lodabar." And then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Ammiel, from Lodabar. Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and prostrated himself. And David said, "Mephibosheth." And he said, "Here is your servant." And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." And again he prostrated himself, and he said, "What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me?" And then the king called Saul's servant Ziba and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I've given to your master's grandson. You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him, and you'll bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in the house of Ziba were servants to Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly. Now he was lame in both feet. What a fascinating story. And the way it is conveyed to us, when we talk about the subject of grace, unmerited favor, the word is found 10 times in the Old Testament, in the New American Standard Version. Only 10 times. But even with the abundance of the use of this word in the New Testament, I would suggest to you that with the exception of Calvary, we will find no greater picture of grace than we find right here in this Old Testament story of Mephibosheth. He is a study in gracefulness. And I'd like to demonstrate why that is tonight as we look at his life. Thanks for being here. I'm happy to be with you again this evening. And it's a special pleasure to be with some of my brothers who labor in the gospel. It is good to be with Nathan, who has come in from his work in Nebraska. It's really good to be with Andy. He has ministered to my heart and mind in his writings through the periodical Think on These Things that I read regularly. And it was through that that I came to be ministered to by Tim and the work that he did this weekend when I found out about that brother's retreat at that campground and the time that we had together. So I am thankful the Lord has given me an opportunity perhaps to share some of the things that I've found in the Word with brothers who have shared a great deal of their lives and thinking with me. What a story. It's interesting that Mephibosheth, from the very first mention of his name to the last, one of the last times he's mentioned, is preceded in the mentioning of his name by the fact that he's lame. We know he's lame before we know his name. It's the son, the grandson of Saul, the son of Jonathan, who falls, and it says, and he was lame in both feet, and his name was Mephibosheth. Almost as if his name isn't nearly as important as the fact that he was lame in both feet. And then the story in chapter 9 goes on to tell us all about him. And we're reminded by Ziba, he is lame. Remember, he's crippled in both feet. And then the very last thing said about him in verse 13, just so that we'll remember, he's not healed, nobody makes him well. Now, he was lame in both feet. That's a very important part of the story. And that's why the writer keeps telling us about him. So here's what I want to do. I want to deal with, first of all, David. I want to tell you a little bit about him and why he is a magnificent man full of grace in this chapter 9. And then I want to tell you a little bit about Mephibosheth. And then, as we've done in all of our other lessons in this series so far, I want to make an application. I don't want you to go away from here saying, so what? So what am I supposed to do with that? Just go back and say, well, that's a good story. I didn't know that one before. No. There are some very important applications for us to make about our lives in this story. So, let's talk about David, a man full of grace. What motivates David to search for someone from the house of Saul upon whom he can bestow favor? And you know, there's only one answer to that. If it were in our political system today, and it were President Bush, or the former president, President Clinton, or the former president, President Bush, or go back as far as you want, many of us would say, if they said, is there somebody in my opponent's house to whom I can show favor? We would say, oh, what a political move. Must be election time. Got to be election time, motivated. That's the only thing that would motivate him. He's just looking for votes. He's looking for power. He's looking for the acclaim of the people. His approval rating is low, and he wants to shoot it back up. That's the way we'd think. But that's not what motivates David at all. In fact, he's early in his kingdom. His approval ratings are very high. The Jerusalem Times is reporting regularly, I say that tongue in cheek, that David's soaring among the people. The greatest king Israel has ever had. David for re-election. What motivates him then? Love. A covenant he had made with Jonathan. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, when Jonathan and David met, and Saul is seeking David's life, and Jonathan says, I'll tell you what my father's doing so that you can avoid this situation. In chapter 20, verses 14 and 15, Jonathan says these words to David. If I'm still alive, verse 14, 1 Samuel 20, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? You hear that? If something happens to my daddy, Jonathan says, I know God has made you king. I know that. Don't let me die. Don't do what kings do when they become king. Don't destroy the offspring of the former king. Will you show me loving kindness that I may not die? And then he says this in verse 15. You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever. Not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. David, if God says destroy all your enemies, and He brings that about by His power, please, David, don't raise your hand against my children. Let them live, please. That's the covenant I beg of you. And David makes a covenant with Jonathan. And they swear upon that covenant and fall upon each other's shoulders and weep. And David weeps all the more over that. It is that which motivates David here. I owe Jonathan something. Is there anybody in the house of Saul left alive? Anybody. Doesn't even have to be Jonathan's offspring. Is there anybody in Saul's house I can just give a gift to? You know, The life of Elvis Presley was a very interesting life. If you ever saw the house in which he was raised in Tupelo, Mississippi, just a small shotgun house. I've been to that house. I've seen it before they moved it to a big museum setting. I saw it on its original grounds. And Elvis Presley, who worked his way up through the music industry and suddenly became famous, was known for one thing that was really unusual for him: bestowing great gifts upon people he didn't even know. Giving away pink Cadillacs to people. Buying cars or houses or buying out a park and inviting people he didn't even know to come and enjoy that with him. The largesse of his heart, the willingness to share what he had with others, endeared him to the common people. And he didn't do it for show. Most people never even knew what he had done, except those who received those gifts. And David here just wants to give something to someone in the house of Saul. Is there anybody left alive? He's not a political move. He's not out to prove anything to anybody. He's not out to make a statement about himself. He just wants to show that. And here's what I want you to note about this. David doesn't say, is there anybody deserving of my grace or my gifts? He doesn't say, is there anybody that I owe something to? Is there anybody in Saul's house who's maybe spoken some nice words about me lately? Is there anybody in Saul's house who might be helpful to me in my political career? Is there anybody out there who can do something for me? He doesn't ask that. He doesn't ask, is there anybody out there who has done something for me? He just says, is there anybody out there who needs a gift? I love that. It's one thing to give a gift to somebody on a birthday. And I think we'd have to admit, when we look at that coldly and logically, even a birthday gift doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What, you're rewarded because you happen to live another year? But to give a gift when there's nothing involved, oh, you want to win the favor of somebody. You want someone to love you and remember you. Just give them something because you want to give them something. Well, what's a special occasion? There is no special occasion. You're special. I just wanted to give this to you. Oh, you'll be remembered for that. And that is what David does. That is his motivation. He doesn't ask those questions. And then I want you to know one more thing about this, David. Look again with me when he calls in Ziba in verse 2. And he asks, when Ziba says, I'm your servant, in verse 3, David says, is there not yet anyone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God? And Ziba said to the king, well, there's still a son of Jonathan who's crippled in both feet. Now, he hasn't even given his name yet. Again, that's to Ziba, that's not very important. I think Mephibosheth could almost be a nameless person. He could almost be like the woman at Tekoa. He just seems to be so insignificant. The only thing anybody remembers him for is the fact that he's Jonathan's son and he's lame. He's done nothing of note, nothing of record. He's not a particularly bright person as far as we know. We don't know anything at all about him. There is nothing worthy of Mephibosheth. Except that David wants to do a favor for someone in Saul's house. But when Ziba says he's crippled in both feet, I want you to think, you know, we live in an ADA compliant community. David's palace was not ADA compliant. Somebody's got to carry Mephibosheth. He can't work. David does not ask the question. This is so noble. He does not ask the question, well, how crippled is he? What are we going to have to do for him if I do a favor for him? He doesn't ask, you know, how bad is it? Just tell me. I mean, is it somebody that's going to require 24-hour a day attention? You know, you think about this for a moment now. I'm serious, folks, and I'm not trying to talk cold-heartedly at all. But if you were wanting to adopt a child, and you wanted to bestow your love on an adopted child, and you called an agency or a person who had a child to adopt, and they said, "We do have a child for adoption, but we need to tell you the child is crippled." Is there one of us that wouldn't at least ask the question? That's not to say we'd turn him away, but that wouldn't at least ask the question, well, how crippled? How handicapped is that child? What's the nature of the handicap before I commit myself? David doesn't do that. There's still a son of Jonathan who is crippled in both feet. And the king said, where is he? Not what is he? Not how is he? Where is he? I don't care. Now that's a big deal, this crippled in both feet. It's mentioned in chapter 4. It's mentioned by Ziba at the beginning of chapter 9. It's mentioned in the middle of chapter 9. It's mentioned at the end of chapter 9. But to David, it is a non-issue. That tell you something about the heart of David? How big it is? How full of grace he is? He doesn't say, oh, crippled. Oh, I'd love to help, but man, we are just not equipped to handle that. Just not ready to handle that. He says, where is he? Now I want to look at Mephibosheth for a moment. He is a man who is filled with grace. If David is full of it, he passes it on to Mephibosheth. I want to show you how blessed Mephibosheth is. First of all, he should have been doomed to regicide. Should have died in his early age. I mean, that's the way kings went out. I've already told you that. But even if he hadn't died of regicide, he should have died of poverty. It's a wonder he's alive at all. He's living in the home of Machir in Lodabar. He's just living at someone else's goodwill. He has nothing of his own. All of his father's lands, all of his father's fortune, it's all gone because David restores it. David tells Ziba, you take care of him. You take care of the fields. You harvest them. You bring the food. You won't have to worry about Mephibosheth eating it, but he can sell it. He can live off of it. He's going to be a man of agricultural wealth. And you're going to take care of him. You and your sons and your servants. He should have died. He should have died more than once. His lameness should have killed him. In that culture, one does not coddle those who cannot take care of themselves. They die. And then he is blessed by David beyond comprehension. Can you imagine what must have been in his heart when he's first summoned to David's home? Oh, he found me. He's found me. David the king wants you. And they bring him in. And he falls on his face. He lays face down before David. He comes to him not knowing what the results of that is. Here is your servant. And then when David says, don't fear, it's because he is fearful. I imagine David sees Mephibosheth sweating on the floor, trembling. His eyes rolled back in his head. He's there to die. The king has found him. Perhaps the last living relative of Saul. He's found him. He's going to die. And David's first words are, don't fear. I'm not going to kill you. In fact, I'm going to restore to you all the land of your grandfather and you're going to eat at my table. You're moving in with us. And then Mephibosheth makes a statement. What is your servant that you should regard a dead dog like me? You know, there are dogs that are useful. The Israelites never really thought much about the usefulness of dogs. Dogs in the Old Testament are considered to be pariah. They're just scavenger beasts. Much like we'd consider a hyena or some other wild animal. So don't think of dogs as being man's best friend, noble creature. When he says, if he had just said that you would regard a dog like me, he would have been using the same terminology as a Syrophoenician woman to Jesus. Yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from the table. But he says a dead dog. You know, there are some dogs that are useful and there are some dogs that are useless. I can't imagine a more useless dog than a dead one. I mean, I can't imagine a more useless creature than to buy for your children a dead dog. It certainly would save you money, but it's not going to be much use. Take the dog out and play with it. What do we do? Well, watch it. Well, that's not hard. It's dead. That you would regard a dead dog like me. He calls himself a dead dog. What he's saying is, I am the most useless of creatures. Why would you regard me? Why is he useless? He's lame in both feet. He can't walk. He can't get up and go to the things that David would have him come to. He's got to be carried. He can't be useful to David. He's a dead dog. And yet, look how he's blessed. David takes a dead dog and restores all the lands of his father to him. He's got all the inheritance of Saul. And he's got a man to take care of him who has 12 sons and 20 servants. That's a huge number of people to take care of his lands. He is blessed beyond his ability. But more than that, beyond his comprehension. Mephibosheth never sat around saying, "Well, I'm just waiting for somebody to restore my fortunes. It's coming soon. I'm sure it's coming. We've got a case in court, and I'm sure it's going to come up pretty soon. I've got good lawyers. We're going to be able to petition the government. David's going to restore the lands." He does not entertain that at all. This is beyond his comprehension. But now I want to talk to you about one particular blessing that you may have overlooked in this story. But I want to show you, of all the things that Mephibosheth gets, the promise of life, the restoration of all of his father's crops and fields, the service of Ziba and his whole household and manservants, there's something even greater than all of those things. Let me read for you again four verses. Verse 7. David said, "Do not fear, for I will surely show kindness to you for the sake of your father Jonathan, and will restore to you all the land of your grandfather Saul, and you shall eat at my table regularly." Look at verse 10. "You and your sons and your servants shall cultivate the land for him." This is said to Ziba. "And you shall bring in the produce so that your master's grandson may have food. Nevertheless, Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall eat at my table regularly." Look at verse 11. "Then Ziba said to the king, 'According to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so your servant will do.' So Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of the king's sons." And then verse 13. "So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate at the king's table regularly." Let me tell you why that's mentioned four times, ladies and gentlemen. It is mentioned four times because it is the greatest blessing Mephibosheth got. Now, I want you to think about this. A man who has had to live off the goodwill of another man in a very poverty-stricken area called Lodabar now will eat the king's fare every day. I want you to imagine the best restaurant you know of. I don't know where it is. I don't know what it is. I want you to think of the best restaurant you've ever eaten at and imagine that you have suddenly gotten a gift certificate that enables you to eat there every day for the rest of your life. I want you to imagine that. Now, wouldn't that be something? I'm sure we're not talking White Castle here, folks. He eats at the king's table. Do you imagine David says, "Well, what are we having today? We got Pop-Tarts and grits." Not at David's table. No, we don't really know exactly what they ate at David's table. We do have one rendition of one of Solomon's meals, and it is incredible. But kings eat like kings. And now Mephibosheth gets to eat whatever the king eats every day. What sumptuous fare fit for a king. But I want you to know something else about that. It says there's a word that comes into that every single time in all four of those verses. Regularly. And in one of the verses it says he ate at David's table as one of his own children. Now, could I just call upon you to use your imagination for a moment and let us just stand against the wall and watch one of David's meals. The table is being set by the servants. It is a big banquet. I mean, there are all kinds of people who are going to be here. But David's family is coming together for a meal. And I'll tell you, I don't know if there's a more interesting family in all the Old Testament than David's family would have been. Watch them as they come in. First of all, we've got Amnon coming in, this clever, crafty, princely son of David. And as he comes in and sits at the table, he is joined soon by Tamar, the beautiful daughter of David. Wise, intelligent, and innocent. And she takes her place by Amnon. At this point, it's a beautiful relationship of half-brother to half-sister. Not at all like what is going to transpire in the near future, as we've already talked about in one of our earlier lessons. And then in comes Solomon. I cannot imagine what Solomon must have been like as a young man. Did he come in thinking wise things and sharing them at the table? Now, I know that it's not until Solomon becomes king that God blesses him with wisdom. I realize that. But it takes a wise person to ask for wisdom. He is no dolt. Solomon is an intelligent, bright young man who probably at this age already has developed a great love for Proverbs. Can't you see Solomon coming in and he's got his pen out and he's writing, "A shekel saved is a shekel earned." Oh, I like that. I'll share that one at the table. "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver." I want to remember that one. That's a good one. Can you see Solomon, this bright young man, loving his father, coming into the table? And then the mothers of these children come in and take their place. Bathsheba, Micah, Abigail. These bright women. These women with great knowledge. And in some cases with a great love for the Lord. And then in comes Joab. I must tell you, Joab is one of my favorite characters in all the Old Testament. If God ever gives you a friend who loves you as much as Joab loved David, you are richly blessed in this life. And this brooding general comes in and sets those massive forearms down on the table and looks down the table and maybe talks about some of the campaigns he's engaged in. Solomon offers a little bit of advice and Amnon says something. And then in comes the really kingly one. In walks Absalom. "Sorry I'm late. Took me a while to do my hair this morning." Raven-haired, absolutely gorgeous man. Beautiful man. An erudite, all the table conversation. Can you imagine it going back and forth? And David entertaining them with a couple of his songs or talking about his days. "Have I ever told you about Goliath?" "Yeah, Dad, we heard about that one." Can you imagine what that table was like? I'm telling you, if we only knew, we would probably give a fortune to have sat at that table once. And Mephibosheth ate at the king's table regularly. So here is this man who has no right to be there. Who has done nothing deserving of being there. Who gets to be pushed up to that table every day. And sit there and listen to the conversation. And join in. And hear David say to him, "Mephibosheth, pass the salt." And to ask him, "How do you like the food? What do you think?" "Well, the meat's a little undercooked. Let's get some more meat out here." Mephibosheth ate at David's table as one of his own children. "You get to pick the meal today, Mephibosheth. You got the red plate today. You're the special guest today." Whatever it may have been, Mephibosheth is part of the family. If you think I'm making too much of this, I remind you four times that chapter tells us this was the blessing. And I have no doubt many nights Mephibosheth left that table not only full of food, but full of heart, because he was full of grace. David's grace passed on to him. Let me tell you why that story is important, folks. Because Mephibosheth is me. Go back and look at the story again. I was an heir of great blessings in my father Adam's house. Given dominion over all the world. In which not only did all creation submit itself to him, but the very earth itself submitted itself to him. My family had an inheritance in the Garden of Eden. I could have grown up eating of the tree of life and the knowledge of good and evil. But because of my father's sin, we were cast out. His sin wasn't mine any more than Saul's sins were Mephibosheth's. But because of the association of family, I lost my inheritance. Just like Mephibosheth lost the inheritance of his grandfather. And it was sin that cast us out. And then I engaged in sin. And I fell from that position of grace. And I became crippled, living in pain and a fear of extinction. Because all who live in sin fear death. And all who live in sin fear hell. And all who live in sin fear God. And all my life while I was in sin, I feared that God would call me to Him and that I would die forever from His presence. And just as David sought the family of Jonathan because of his love for Jonathan, Jonathan, who surrendered his power to David and made himself subservient to the will of David to save his household, God sought me because of His Son's surrender. As Jesus died for the salvation of His family, as Jesus made a covenant with God that His family might be spared, God sought me. He said, "Is there anyone in the house of my son Jesus to whom I might show my kindness?" And God sought me. And just as Mephibosheth had nothing and did nothing and deserved nothing, yet he got greater things than if he had been Saul's heir until death. Mephibosheth couldn't have had it any better, even if Saul had lived until Mephibosheth died. Had Saul lived, Mephibosheth couldn't have had it any better than he had it in the household of David. So also, my life now is so much richer than it was as a son of Adam. Because now I live in the house of the King of all the ages. And His dining with David parallels our dining with greatness. You know what's really interesting? In the Bible, and this is a fairly frequent thing, even Jesus says it in Matthew chapter 8 and verse 11, that people will come from the east and west to dine with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Even Jesus realizes one of the great blessings is eating together. Even Jesus, when He described the great blessings that will come upon those who, upon whom God shows favor, centered it around eating at the table. Can you imagine taking your tray of food to the table of heaven and looking across that table to be introduced to Abraham? Can you imagine what it will be like to sit down and ask Paul to talk about what he meant in this particular passage? To sit at table with Ruth and say, "Ruth, what was going through your mind?"
when your mother-in-law's husband died and your husband died and Orpah's husband died and the famine came, what was going through your mind? And to talk to Ruth, to talk to Rahab, and to ask Joshua, if he will, to recount one more time that battle of Jericho from his viewpoint. Can you imagine? That is the blessing we have. That is my blessing, because I am Mephibosheth and my father has blessed me with grace. I have been adopted into royalty. You're looking at the physical body of Ralph Walker, son of Ralph Walker, son of William Walker, and there's a long heritage of nobodies, of which I am the latest nobody. But I want to tell you what you don't see. I am an adopted son of the God of the ages. Did you know that? My God has adopted me. And as Romans chapter 8 verse 15 says, He has sent His Spirit into me so that I cry with the spirit of adoption, Abba, Father, Daddy, Father. I can talk to my Father in heaven because I am His child. And if you ask me, what did you do to get that, Ralph? I would say, what, oh God, have you done to a dead dog like me? And He has blessed me with grace. And though I may always limp as a reminder of my sin, God's grace is sufficient for my life. But what I have just said about myself can be said of every child of God. God has invited us to His table to be His children by adoption and welcomed us to this great banquet feast with the righteous of all the ages. My reservation is there not because of anything I've done, but because God has bestowed His grace on me. Now, I do not want to leave a false impression with you that God has somehow arbitrarily chosen me and a handful of other people, and that there is nothing anybody else can do to come to that banquet table, because God has extended the invitation to whosoever will. But they must come to Him, and they must hear His words, and they must, like Mephibosheth, must live under the rules and the authority of the household of the king. And so tonight, if you would be free from your handicapped state in sin, if you will renounce your inheritance to the God of this world and the family of the Adam of this world, and be adopted into the family of the second Adam, Jesus Christ, if tonight you would come to the Lord, you must believe that God is, and that He rewards those who diligently seek Him. And that you must believe that Jesus is the Son of God, that He died for you, and that it was that that made the provisions for God to extend His grace to you. And you must turn away from living your former life and now live for Jesus and live for the household of God, and live by the rules of His table and His dominion. And you must put off the man of sin and bury it in the waters of baptism and rise to walk a new life. I have one more passage for you and will extend the invitation immediately after the reading of this. It is Titus chapter 3, verses 3 through 7. For we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. But when the kindness of God, our Savior, and His love for mankind appeared, He saved us. Not on the basis of deeds which we've done in righteousness, but according to His mercy, by the washing of regeneration and renewing by the Holy Spirit, whom He poured out upon us richly through Jesus Christ our Savior, so that being justified by His grace, we would be made heirs according to the hope of eternal life. You believe that? If you believe that and you have not cast yourself upon Jesus Christ and made Him Lord and King of your life, you need to do that tonight. That the gracefulness of Mephibosheth may be yours. That you may be filled with the grace of your King and my King, who invites you, come eat at His table. Will you come? Please come while we stand and sing this song.